spake unto Moses, saying, Command the children of Israel that they bring unto thee pure oil olive, beaten for the light, to cause the lamps to burn continually in the tabernacle of the congregation. And it shall be a statute forever in your generation.
The Eternal Light. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Eternal Light. This program comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Our story today is a dramatization by Morton Wishengrad of a portion of Ira A. Hirschman's Lifeline to a Promised Land. The narrator is Raymond Edward Johnson.
You feel like the man in a nightmare. You tell yourself. You keep saying it over and over. You keep telling yourself, there's a way out. There must be a way out. There's always a way out. That's what you keep telling yourself. You mustn't give up hope. You can't. And then you see it. A door. An open door. You don't rush to it. After all, you're a civilized man. There's a question of human dignity involved. You're quite nonchalant, casual. You don't even walk. You saunter to the open door. It's easy now. What in all the world was all the nervousness about? Nothing but ridiculous hysteria. Why, it's a great, big, wide-open door. Why, here it is. There's nothing to it. You're practically out. Sure. Except, just as you get there, it happens. Just like the man in the nightmare. It always happens. Got to find a way out. It's not for yourself. You can bear it if it's for yourself. It's for others. Thousands of others. Hundreds of thousands. More than 1 million. 2 million. Men and women and children. Innocent people who are trapped without even the imputation of guilt. Your breath comes heavily now. Sweat is standing on your face. Your chest cavity is too small for your heart. And then... then you see another open door. And you aren't very casual about it now. No more sauntering. The door has to be open. It has to be held open for them. It must. You must get there quickly. You must hold it open. You must. Hold it! A terrible nightmare. Pinch yourself. It's only a dream. Pinch yourself. But it isn't a dream. You pinch yourself and it hurts. In a minute there'll be a blue mark. It isn't a dream. It's all true. All of it is true. There are many doors. Doors that are ajar. Doors that are half open. Doors that are open wide. But each time you draw near, the door slams shut. Now to tell you my name, Ira A. Hirschman. But nightmares are things that don't happen. Not in broad daylight, not in full view of the whole world. This is the demented thing. The world isn't demented, is it? Is it? I'm not demented. I'm a rational man. I was rational in January 1944 when President Roosevelt named me Special Attaché of the State Department and told me to open the doors. Open the doors. John W. Paley, director of the War Refugee Board in Washington. Paley put a name on one of the doors.
Transnistria. Hirschman, look at the map. Here between the Bug and the Dniester rivers, the Romanians sent 175,000 Jews and other anti-fascists. Only 50,000 remain alive. Transnistria. Hirschman, see what you can do about it.
So you flew to Ankara because Turkey was a neutral, because Turkey was the strategic window. More than a window, the door, the great, enormous door to the Balkans where 4 million were trapped or already dead. You flew to Ankara. I will say something to you. They say the planet is shrinking. That's a cliche. It took me less than a week to fly between New York and Ankara. But Ankara and New York are no closer together than they've ever been. They are still separated by the distance between two civilizations. In Ankara, I met American Ambassador Lawrence Steinhardt. He was not a meticulous silk hat diplomat. Persons meant more to him than protocol. Steinhardt said,
Hirschman, Turkey could be a funnel, but Turkey is a bottleneck. Only 180 refugees are allowed to come in by rail each week. At that rate, it'll be 200 years before the last refugee passes through.
It was 1944. We were at war. Turkey was a neutral on the side of Germany. But Bulgaria and Romania and Hungary were openly Axis satellites. They were our enemies. And it was my mission to open the doors.
Hirschman, the president has given you extraordinary powers. You're even permitted to negotiate with the enemy.
But words don't unlatch doors. I had to open doors with visas. The Germans slaughtered wholesale. It was ruthless, efficient, and methodical. This is how we, the Allies, obtained one single visa for one single victim of the Nazis.
My name is Chaim Bailash, Jewish agency representative in Turkey. I must have the correct name, address, and date of birth of the refugee. It takes 2 to 3 weeks.
Then he has to send his data to the Jewish agency in Palestine.
I'm a member of the Jewish agency in Palestine. We submit the data to the British Palestine government for approval.
The British authority in Palestine then sends its approval to London.
From London, the authorized list goes to the British passport officer in Istanbul.
From Istanbul, it goes to the British embassy in Ankara.
From the British embassy in Ankara, it goes to the Turkish Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
And then, naturally, it must be considered in turn by the military, the police, and other departments responsible for the national welfare.
Finally, the name of the refugee is dispatched to the Turkish consul in Bucharest, Budapest, and Sofia. And if he is still alive, he receives a visa to enter Turkey.
Death becomes much less complicated than living. It was our job to open the doors. We opened them. Ambassador Steinhardt and I were able to reduce the waiting period to a relatively short time, but it is in place to say a word here about the red tape, the inefficiency, and the transparent lack of interest in the embassies. Their bureaucratic mentality, malevolence, and ill will complicated matters as much as did the severity of the statutes. When ships with a desperate human cargo were permitted neither to sail nor to land and were so overcrowded and unseaworthy that they sank to the bottom, there was always this kind of solace delivered in a most cultured tone of voice.
Under the present unhappy situation of the world, it is to a certain extent inevitable that we should be hardened to horrors.
But why did it always seem necessary to reserve the worst horrors for those friendly to our cause? Years ago in Turkey, even the thin trickle of refugees had dried up. 80 refugees from Bulgaria were permitted to enter Turkey each week. None came. Why? We were at war with Bulgaria, but Russia was not. I went to Sergei Vinogradov, the Russian ambassador.
Hirschman, I will give you some advice. It is this. You should go home. Among the Bulgarians, Romanians, and Turks, you will get nowhere. You will get only endless postponements and obstacles.
But what is a door if it doesn't open a gap in what has been a wall? I had to stay. At the beginning of the war, the British had agreed under the White Paper to admit 75,000 immigrants in Palestine. But the figures were merely statistics.
Sorry, this man has no visa, no papers. He is an illegal immigrant. He cannot enter.
Does the lack of a piece of stamped paper make a human life illegal? These were human lives saved from countries overrun by the Nazi. Would the Nazi himself grant exit permits or transit visas to make the immigration legal? Instead of filling the quota, vacancies were held open for hypothetical refugees with visas. While many thousands of the victims of this technicality were sent back to Axis countries and went to fill waiting graves. Listen, this is Breckinridge Long, assistant to the Secretary of State.
Literally, the records of the reports of the consular officers to the State Department form one of the most saddening and awful pages of our humanitarian history.
This is also the proper place to single out for praise the names of Alfred C. Mabee in the British Embassy and former United States Consul General Burton Y. Berry. Their service went beyond government. They served humanity. I learned things. Once there had been hundreds of visas for children. And for 2 years, the children had been herded along the borders of Bulgaria while the visas had either been lost or pigeonholed. But these were wandering children, little hungry children who had been trapped once and escaped, and sometimes trapped a second, a third, and a fourth time. What a civilization that does not offer sanctuary even to helpless 6 and 7-year-old children. I made a determined effort to find their visas. I went to the Turkish officials.
Excuse it, please, but we do not have the visas here. Very likely they're being withheld in Sofia by the Bulgarians.
I went to the British.
There is a strong likelihood that the visas have been delayed by the Turkish embassy in Ankara.
In desperation, I sent an urgent request for help to the War Refugee Board in Washington.
From Special Attaché Ira A. Hirschman in Ankara to John W. Paley in Washington, D.C. Can you obtain cooperation from London through top levels? Urgently need to locate lost visas for homeless children along Bulgarian border.
London to British Embassy in Ankara. Take parallel action to aid Hirschman in matter of visas for homeless children.
I do not know what means Paley and his colleagues used, but suddenly the visas turned up in the British Embassy, where they had been on ice as a result of a technicality. They were quickly approved. Within 3 weeks of my arrival in Ankara, 4,500 children who had been approved for admission into Palestine as long ago as 1942 began to leave Bulgaria for Istanbul. They came along a thin lifeline. 100 children a week. It was a start. And it served to invigorate both Ambassador Steinhardt and me. That was one door unlocked. Now it was time to open a second door.
The Turkish government has been issuing transit visas through Turkey on the condition that the refugees leave Istanbul within 24 hours of their arrival. The Turks have stopped all entrance visas because many refugees are staying longer than 24 hours.
I looked into it. I spoke to a refugee.
It's true. I don't want to stay in Turkey. But how can I leave for Palestine when I have no permit to enter?
I went to the Turkish government.
Until they get out in 24 hours, as per agreement, no further entrance visas will be issued.
But how can we get out when we are denied transportation facilities and entry visas?
Round and round, a merry-go-round made of slamming doors. The Turks made a demand. It was logical and justified.
We want a letter from the British government guaranteeing that all refugees entering Turkey will be permitted by the British to leave Istanbul for Palestine.
And here was the bitter irony. The British government had not refused the required commitment. The British government had, in fact, prepared the letter and sent it. The trouble was...
The letter has been mislaid somewhere.
I had the letter located. Again in the British Embassy. And another door, another small door, began to open. I'd been going round and round in a seemingly endless circle of frustration. I'd run to a door only to find it shut. I'd felt like the man in a nightmare. The doors had slammed in my face. But now they were beginning to open. And a trickle, a faint, pathetic trickle, was beginning to go through. Now it was time to turn to the bigger jobs.
Transnistria. Hirschman, look at the map. Here between the Bug and the Dniester rivers, the Romanians sent 175,000 Jews and other anti-fascists. Only 50,000 remain alive. Transnistria. Hirschman, see what you can do about it.
The Romanians had proved no less efficient than their German allies in persecuting their own people. It was a race against the devil.
Hirschman, these men and women and children in Transnistria are prisoners of the enemy. In other words, you've got to sit down with the enemy and negotiate.
And this was the time when American flying fortresses were bombing the oil fields at Ploiești and making a shambles of the city of Bucharest. It was flying in the face of reason to think that an enemy whom we were destroying would consider any suggestion regarding his own nationals. Under our law, it is a crime against the government of the United States for an American citizen to consult or negotiate with the enemy in time of war. Even ambassadors are subject to this law. But when I had arrived and Ambassador Steinhardt had read my credentials, the first thing he had said to me was...
They have given you the broadest powers of any envoy that I have known. You're even permitted to deal with the enemy.
A direct approach involved infinite hazards. We were not sure of the Romanian minister, Crețianu. Ambassador Steinhardt and I planned every step. We spoke first to Gilbert Simond, Ankara representative of the International Red Cross.
Mr. Simond, we would like to know whether Minister Crețianu of Romania would be interested in talking with a representative of the American government.
Yourself?
No, Mr. Hirschman.
And the subject of the proposed conversation?
Exclusively on the subject of refugees. Can such a meeting be arranged?
Everything is possible, sir.
Telephone could not be trusted in this delicate work. 2 days passed.
Mr. Hirschman. May I suggest that you pay me a friendly visit at my home this coming Saturday? Mr. Crețianu will be there at 5:00. May I suggest that you come 1 hour earlier?
On the hour set for the rendezvous, I slipped into Simon's home. The little sitting room was almost hermetically sealed by blinds. There was a grand piano. While waiting, I tried to loosen my tension by playing some pages from a Beethoven sonata. My fingers trembled. Beethoven was badly served. But the soaring spirit of his music served me well at the moment. The notorious death valley of Transnistria seemed far away, and its forced marches, its cruelties, and its merciless destruction of innocent men and women and children seemed incredible. I played while Gilbert Simond paced the floor. Promptly at 5:00, he was there. Alexander Crețianu entered. We exchanged cards.
Mr. Hirschman, do you mind if I take notes?
He spoke English well. He poised pencil on paper. Then I spoke. Mr. Crețianu, the American government is outraged by the reports we have received of the massacre of your own citizens. Crețianu listened with noncommittal politeness. He was a handsome man with charming manners. His father had once been minister to the United States. We had reason to believe that Alexander Crețianu was ideologically sympathetic to the Allies.
But
precisely do you want? And what do you offer?
First, we request that you abandon the disease-ridden camp at Transnistria at once. And that you return the remaining 48,000 refugees to their homes.
Continue, sir.
We ask, second, that you release 5,000 children from Romania, that you facilitate their passage to the port of Constanta on the Black Sea, that you provide exit certificates for them, and that you expedite the debarkation of ships which will carry them to Istanbul and then to Haifa, Palestine.
Is there a third point, Mr. Hirschman?
Yes. An end to persecution in Romania and the repressive acts against your own minorities.
It is not impossible, Mr. Hirschman. I promise to recommend these measures warmly in a telegram to Bucharest tonight. Mr. Hirschman, what do you offer in return?
It shouldn't be necessary to offer anything to a government to have it free its own citizens.
Then you offer nothing?
The goodwill of the government and the people of the United States of America. These moves will receive widespread publicity in the United States and will serve as a significant indication of a change in the policy of your government away from the Nazis.
Yes. Yes, I understand.
In all my life, I had never watched a man's face so intently. My eyes had been on his face for nearly 3 hours.
I'm interested, Mr. Hirschman.
Good. Mr. Cruciano, I understand that your father made a brilliant record in Washington. Who knows but that the tradition may continue in better times when we are at peace.
I shall telegraph Antonescu with all urgency and warm recommendation.
One week later, I received an urgent call from Gilbert Simon.
Mr. Hirschman, I wonder if you could come over immediately.
I rushed to his house. 5 minutes later, Cresciano hurried into the room. His hair was somewhat disheveled. He had been running. He was still out of breath. But to Simon and to me, he read from an incomplete telegram.
From Antonescu. Instructions have been issued to General George Patopeanu to break up the camp in Transnistria. The 5,000 children will be assisted in reaching the port of embarkation. All persecutions will cease forthwith. Telegram ends here. I did not wait to decode the rest.
He turned to me and to Simon. His handsome face was flushed, and he said quietly,
I am reminded of an old Romanian proverb. To give quickly is to give twice.
Ah, but that is much better in the French. Qui donne tôt donne deux fois.
We smiled at one another. Because of what we had just accomplished, people would live. Romanian anti-fascists of the Jewish and Christian religions. Cresciano said goodbye, and his last sentence has never stopped ringing in my ears.
Hirschman, you should have come before.
Doors are still shut. The war is over, but the work is barely begun. The doors open for a little while, and then only for a few. Now they are virtually bolted. On a July day in 1944, I stood at Istanbul Harbor with Joseph Levy of the New York Times and Dr. Judah Magnus of the Hebrew University in Palestine. We saw 256 children from Transnistria literally hanging from the rigging of the vessel that brought them. We saw them trudge silently to the special train. Here they were at last. Only a few hundred, but children. Not numbers in a report adding to fascism statistics of death. Living human beings ready to live again, marching from hate and persecution toward freedom and hope. We onlookers, we gazed at one another. Before our eyes, we saw a fragmentary segment of a long time in a pilgrimage of men. Maybe it was some instinct for the survival of the human stream that led us to make children our special concern. Looking at a clod, one can imagine the earth. Looking at a child's face, one can see the face of mankind. We were in a quiet mood. The train left. The ferry carried us back. The night shadows slid across the waters. The world seemed to yawn, and the shadows of the masks made fantastic silhouettes on the shifting waters. Arabesques that looked for the moment like mocking figures. The world seemed very tired.
If you would like a free copy of the script you have just heard, write to The Eternal Light, 3080 Broadway, New York 27, New York. Our drama today by Morton Wishengrad was based on sections of Ira A. Hirschman's recent book, Lifeline to a Promised Land. The music was composed by Morris Mamorski and conducted by Milton Catons. The liturgical introduction was sung by cantor David Putterman, and Raymond Edward Johnson was featured as the narrator. The entire production was under the direction of Frank Papp. This program is a weekly presentation of the National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations in cooperation with the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. For a free copy of today's dramatization, write to The Eternal Light, 3080 Broadway, New York 27, New York. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.